One evening at seminary, some friends and I were playing a prohibited game of poker in a common room on campus. It was prohibited because we were gambling for money. And a letter had gone out by the dean explicitly saying that this was not appropriate and could not happen. So when a man, an older gentleman, showed up that none of us knew and peeked his head in the door and said, "Mind if I join you, fellas?" We were a little concerned, but not really knowing how to say no, we invited him in, and he sat down and began to play poker with us. Well, thank God he wasn't from the dean. We weren't busted. Who he was a recently retired priest of a career of over 30 years, and he was a new board member for the seminary, and he was there for a board meeting. And he was bored, and he was looking for something to do. So he found us and joined us for some poker. And over the course of about an hour and a half, 2 hours, he took a lot of money from us. But he also shared these really wonderful stories of the arc of his ministry and the churches that he'd worked for, and how much joy and satisfaction not only that he had from his career, but also that he felt that his communities shared with him. And then he talked about how he was still finding that same joy and enthusiasm and purpose in his retirement. He was a really joyous man. And so it hit me that I had to ask him this question. I said, "Andrew, you are what we all want to be in 30 years. You've lived a full and fruitful career, one that was very satisfying to you and your communities, and now you are finding that same fullness and fulfillment in retirement. What advice would you give to us who are about to start this journey that you've so wonderfully completed?" And Andrew took his cards and put them on the table. He was from the South, and so he said, "Boys, in over 30 years of ministry, not once did someone ask me about theology. What they want to know is, do you love them? So your job is to go out there and become friends with Jesus, and then become friends with Jesus' friends." Not the answer I was expecting. But it stuck with me because I think it's ultimately true. I think Andrew was telling us many things, but one thing that he was sharing with us is that information doesn't really equal transformation. Our gospel today is two disciples who are walking from Jerusalem to the town of Emmaus 3 days after Christ's crucifixion. And they're talking when all of a sudden, Jesus himself, the resurrected Christ, joins them and walks with them. And yet, they don't recognize him. Now, here's the thing. These disciples, they've got lots of information. The first information they have, and the most present to them, is that they know that the tomb is empty. Members of their group have gone and seen that Jesus is no longer in the tomb. Further, they've got the witness from the women that angels appeared to them and said that he is not here, he has risen. So they have the immediate information that the tomb is empty and that Christ is risen, and yet they're unwilling to believe it. Secondarily, they have the historic information of the Hebrew scriptures, the scriptures that told them, and they say this in their own words, that they believed Jesus to be the Messiah, the one sent and referred to in scripture to save and redeem Israel. But unfortunately, they've got that information wrong. We'll get to that in a second. What we have is a couple disciples so confused and distrusting of the information they have that we're literally told they're sad and confused. In fact, there are theologians out there that say about this passage, Jesus actually isn't trying to hide himself from the disciples. They're just so caught in their way of understanding things and their concept of what should be, that their information has blinded them to Jesus in their midst. What's even further, they actually are arrogant enough to say to Jesus, "You haven't heard about Jesus?" So first, we are introduced to Jesus the informer. And he's listened to him for enough, and he finally says, "How foolish you are." And he begins with Moses and walks them through the entirety of the Hebrew Scriptures and shows them that the Messiah, the chosen one, had to actually come and suffer before entering into his fullness. You see, the predominant thought at that day and age, and through most of Jewish history, is that the Messiah would come back as a conquering warrior. He'd come back as a general with arms and gather an army of Israelites, and they would by force kick the Romans out of Israel and establish the kingdom of Israel again on earth. But Jesus says to them, no, that's not it at all. That's not what the Scriptures say at all. The Scriptures say that the Messiah is to suffer before rescuing and redeeming Israel. So now, the disciples have the correct information. But they still don't see him. Information doesn't always equal transformation. And then we get to the point of the Scripture that really, really I enjoy. We get to the invitation. So they get to where they're going, and the Scriptures tell us that Jesus goes on as if he was going ahead. And I wonder, what if the disciples had said, "Thanks for the information, see you later." And they would have not invited him home and simply gone there themselves. They, again, would have had all the information, but would have missed out on the transformative presence of Christ in their lives. Now, let me say this clearly. Hospitality back in that day and age, both for Jews and for Romans, was a deeply holy act. It was sacred. Offering someone or inviting someone into your home offered them protection, food, safety. It was like treating someone else as a member of one's family. It was radical and could be offensive if you invited somebody you shouldn't have to your house. Think about this. The Pharisees got outrageously upset when Jesus ate with tax collectors, prostitutes, and sinners. It was because he was accepting the hospitality of people he should not have been with. And so these disciples, they opened themselves up to the transformative power of Christ by inviting them into their homes and their lives. The openness to being transformed and to transformation is grounded in the act of invitation. First to Jesus, and then to Jesus' friends. So once they invite Jesus into their home and their lives, then we are introduced to Jesus the Transformer. And here's what's interesting. When he gets into their house, the Scripture says that he actually takes the lead, which is weird. He's the one who grabs the bread and blesses it and breaks it. That's odd because traditionally it would be the host who did that action. But what Scripture is telling us is that when we invite Jesus into our lives, then Jesus is going to do the work from there. He's in charge, and so he will take the lead in offering us an experience of his true self through his presence and through the bread, through the meal. We don't have to worry about it. He'll do the work. We just got to invite him in. And it's through this invitation and ultimately his breaking of the bread, of that holy moment of sharing a meal, of being intimate with each other in a radical way, that they finally see that it's Jesus. They get through the transformative experience that that's who's been with them the entire time. And although Jesus disappears, all of a sudden that information they got on the walk becomes not simply intellectual, it becomes visceral. They say, "Were not our hearts burning when he was revealing the Scripture to us?" So they understand the information differently, or at least they acknowledge it, knowing and being transformed by the risen Christ. Further, their lives are radically transformed. Yes, from that moment on, but actually even that night. I mean, they get up and they run back to Jerusalem, 7 miles. I'm sure their plans were probably to settle in, eat a good meal, and go to bed. When's the last time you ran 7 miles? I wouldn't want to do that after a big meal, but they do it. They get up and they go because they realize that the purpose of their life has changed dramatically, and they must follow this new way of life. Jesus calls us to be transformed, not just informed, and to transform, not just inform. Now, don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying information is bad. We are faithful Episcopalians. We like reason. We like intelligence. It's a beautiful aspect of who we are. So I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying it's not central. It's the reason why we understand that Jesus didn't come to give us a rule book. But God came as God's very self to be one of us, to live as one of us, to die as one of us, and be raised as one of us for us. And so the Jesus way of life, while it includes information, it's really invitation, experience, and transformation in relationship. So here's the first question I have, or invitation, if you will. How are we inviting Jesus into our lives? And I got to tell you, I thought about this morning on my drive here, and I realized, you know, I'm a priest. My day-to-day job is all this religious stuff. And there are times where I get so caught up, I forget to simply invite Jesus into my life. So driving here, I simply said in a quick prayer, Jesus, I invite you into my life. Now, there's other ways of doing it, more dynamic. There's the consistent practice of prayer, of fasting, of meditation, of silence, of solitude, of worship here today. But I want to invite you to be intentional about inviting Jesus into your life. Don't get caught up so much in the routine of what we do. Take the moment to actively say, Jesus, come on in. The next thing I want to ask or invite is that, how are we inviting Jesus' friends, or yet-to-be friends, into the Jesus way of life? This last week, there was the annual big gathering of the Technology, Entertainment, and Design Talks, TED Talks. Are you familiar with those? They're events all over the country, but once a year, they gather the best and most sort of cutting-edge talks for a day or two of these 20-minute talks. And one of the surprising presenters this year was Pope Francis. Pope Francis did about an 18-minute talk, and the topic of the weekend was the future you. And Pope Francis started out that indeed, the future is you, individually and uniquely, because God has created each one of us individually in a unique way and to serve a unique purpose, to partner with God uniquely to fulfill his kingdom in a way that only you can do. And yet Pope Francis points out that there is not simply the individual you, there is the communal you, the we, the us, that we together are a unique identity. And he extends it further to say that the best life includes everyone on earth. And that we are mysteriously but definitively connected in profound ways, each one of us to all of us. And so he talks about a need for solidarity. And not just in a labor sense, but in recognizing that we are not simply the human race, we are the human family. And that we are to look out for one another because we actually belong to one another. And he talks about a revolution, not of violence, but of tenderness, that we need to see and love one another as two children in joyous play see and love one another. We need to be tender with one another. And he lifts up from Scripture the example of the Good Samaritan as the iconic example of what it means to, in a faith perspective, have solidarity and tenderness towards one another. And finally, he also quotes Mother Teresa as saying, one cannot love unless it is at one's own expense. The future us is full of love and tenderness, and it will cost us something. This Jesus way of life, of invitation and experience, it's going to inconvenience us. It's going to require that we let go of what we know and our way of doing things. It's going to require that we be open to the presence of Christ in our midst and not be blind to God because we know what we're doing. But this way of life will lead to a radical transformation of ourselves, of other people, and the entire world. So it's to this wonderful life that Jesus invites us to stand up with our hearts burning, push our chips, and say, I'm all in.